You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, welcome into a Wednesday edition of Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast that breaks down every Heat game, news item, rumor, and more. Thanks for listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on the brand new podcast app, Himalaya. My name is Wes Goldberg, and I'm here with David Ramil. We have an NBA draft-themed mailbag for you today. We've got questions about Andrew Wiggins, D'Angelo Russell, the best and worst draft picks in Heat history, but we'll start with this question from Chris Leach, who writes in, do you guys have any idea why Kevin Porter Jr. and Romeo Langford seem to be falling down draft boards? And does this make a potential trade back more intriguing? I've seen Kevin Porter anywhere from 18 to 23. David, what do you think?
I think we're just starting to see a lot of information kind of be leaked out. And you know, teams are kind of putting out there that they're leaning towards ex-player. Agents get involved a lot more noticeably around this time period right before the draft, where they're starting to say that, you know, their guys have a promise, or that there's expectations that they'll be selected at such and such place. And I think you're also starting to see some fine-tuning as far as, you know, teams having a specific area of need and bringing in a specific player for multiple workouts. In the case of Miami, they brought in both these players, Porter and Langford, in for additional workouts. So you know that there is some natural interest there. And whether this is kind of a smokescreen or kind of, you know, kind of showing that maybe they might be interested in other players, I mean, it's a big game. A lot of it is, you know, kind of positioning yourself. As far as an agent is concerned, they're trying to position their clients in the best way possible so they'll be a top 10 selection, so that they'll make the most money, et cetera. So I wouldn't worry too much about these draft boards, because, to be honest with you, I think it was Sam Vecenie with The Athletic just put his board from the previous season's draft. And although he hit on a lot of selections, they're kind of all over the place. Like, his top 10 somewhat mirrored the top 10 that actually went in the draft, but the order was all wrong. And you're never going to be able to hit on this 100%. There's always some intrigue. There's going to be a trade where a team asks another team to make a selection on their behalf because it fits their need. And so a player that might have gone 15th or 16th might go 12th or 13th or might go 19th, you know? I don't see anything to it. I mean, as far as Porter and Langford is concerned, why they might be dropping a little bit, there's just holes in their games. And I think you're starting to see that. There might be concerns for whether or not their shooting translates to the next level. In the case of Porter, obviously there have been issues about him off the court that might scare some teams off. And with Langford, I think, you know, you have similar issues, and you also have injury concerns. So
right. And none of those things are new, though. And I do think it's sort of interesting, the timing of it is, we knew that the shooting issues were there. We knew that the off-the-court issues with Porter were a concern for teams. None of that. We knew all that stuff.
Yeah.
Day after the college basketball season ended, we knew all of that stuff. So why? Like, and you and I had remarked, I think, you know, a week or two ago, wow, it looks like, you know, Porter seems to be anywhere in between the top
right.
8 and the top 28 in this right. draft, while Romeo Langford is pretty, he's been somewhere. Pretty stable in yeah. his, you know, 10 to 15 range, I would say. But I have noticed what Chris has noticed, and I don't know what mock drafts I'm looking at and if they're necessarily reliable, but I've seen him dropping a couple times. More so, I've seen other guys rising, and I think that's less of a reflection on Langford. I think Porter has fallen. I think he's clearly not the prospect that even Romeo Langford is, or the other top guards in this draft. It seems like he's going to fall. But it does seem like these other guys, like a Keldon Johnson, Nasir yes. Little, PJ yes. Washington, they are rising. And I think that's more of a reflection on teams liking them and their right. upside, more so than maybe disliking. It's more them rising than Langford falling, I should say. And so for that reason, you and I picked Romeo Langford in the Locked On Heat mock draft. It would not surprise me if they selected Langford, but it also wouldn't surprise me if they went in another direction with a bigger player on the perimeter, such as a Nasir Little, a PJ Washington, Grant Williams, Keldon Johnson, one of those guys. Would not surprise me at all.
And I think, you know, it's interesting that you brought up Little and Langford, and both of them are known, if nothing else, for their work ethic and also their athleticism, which is a little bit more explosive than either Langford or Porter. Porter, I think, a little bit more explosive than Langford, but either way, both Little and Keldon Johnson, kind of really superb athletes that really work hard. And those kinds of things tend to come across more easily in individualized workouts. You see this guy busting his butt and kind of, you know, outworking the other guys that he's competing against. And those kinds of things stand out and appeal to GMs and the decision makers. You want to see a guy. And, you know, there's so much that we never really take into consideration. Langford is probably on his fifth visit in 5 days. Like, he's traveling all over the country. And at some point, for a 19-year-old, your shot's going to not fall. You know, you're going to get tired. You're going to get exhausted. You're going to go through this process where you don't even remember what city you're competing in anymore. And I think that takes its toll. And look, I don't know that there's any kind of real way of estimating why they're dropping and other guys are rising. But I think we've hit on a lot of the topics that they're probably seeing as far as other team GMs are concerned.
Mo writes in, what can Justice Winslow fetch in a draft day trade? And I don't think that Mo is necessarily saying that we should, but it is an interesting hypothetical, right? And that's a good way to almost measure your own players. We talked in the last episode about moving Josh Richardson. Would the Pelicans ever consider Josh Richardson for number four straight up?
Right.
You know, not even including the 13th pick. And I think it's just, a good thought process. Justice Winslow, straight up, what kind of pick do you think you can get for him?
Yeah, and I did look at it that way also. Like, I know that a lot of the context we've given to these kind of trade theoreticals is Justice and a pick, or Justice and Dion, or Justice and somebody else, and Josh the same way. Justice straight up, I can't see a lottery pick being traded for a player like Justice Winslow. Not that there isn't upside with a player like Justice. He's still young. I think he has more upside than Josh Richardson, and I think that's the perception around the league as well, is that Winslow has more upside. Like, obviously, he was a theoretical top five pick coming out of the draft, and then he kind of slid to 10. And although he hasn't exactly found his niche just yet, we've seen signs of that over the last season. And I think there's enough playmaking ability, enough improvement in his shot where you could say there's potential there, and he still hasn't realized his ceiling. And so I think from other teams' perspective, you might want to invest a late first round pick at most.
I think you're underselling him a little bit here. He is entering the first year of his contract extension. Versus a player who you're getting on the rookie deal for 4 years. That said, I still think, you know, and obviously there's a big caveat of what draft are we talking about? Who's on the board? Who's picking? What other team? But in general, I think you could probably get something for what the Heat selected him at number 10. I would say somewhere between 10 and 14. I think you get a late lottery pick for him, and then obviously anything beyond that. But I would say that that's probably his value, given that he's still really young. He's versatile. I think teams would like what he can bring to the table defensively. He's proven at that end. And like you said, I think he came on strong towards the end of last season, mid to the end of last season. So I think you'll probably get a late lottery pick for him, all things considered. But let's take a quick break here, and then we'll talk about some possible trades that he could make, maybe Andrew Wiggins, maybe going out and signing D'Angelo Russell. We'll talk about how that could happen, if it can happen. Forever 3 writes in, do you think Andrew Wiggins can maximize his potential in Miami to maybe justify making a gross amount of money? In a perfect world, could you imagine Wiggins averaging 25, 5, and 3 here?
No. That's the answer. I think there are concerns with Wiggins, mostly not about ability. I think it's mostly effort, unfortunately, with him. And maybe that's something that Miami can find a way to tap into. Like, I think the talent's there, but getting him incentivized has been tough, especially now that he's being paid a gross amount of money as Forever 3, right? So, the knock on him has long been his impact is kind of minimized elsewhere. Like, all he does is score. He does not rebound well. He does not make plays for others, etc. He does not even play defense at a particularly high level. Although all those tangibles are there. Like, he has the length, the width, the athleticism, the explosiveness, etc. He just doesn't ever seem to want to tie it all together. And I think that's been the knock, and I think it would continue to be a problem, and I'm not sure what motivates him. If it's not Jimmy Butler lighting a fire in your ass and challenging you every day to get the most out of you, if it's not the fact that you're already getting paid and that you want to be able to prove, at least publicly, that you're worth that kind of money. And I know that puts a lot of pressure on players. I mean, we've talked to players before about the contract demands. It's not just earning that contract. It's once you've earned it, trying to do your best to prove it. And I think with Andrew, he's just I just don't know that he cares. And I'm not sure what it is about him.
I don't know if it's the fact that, hey, he already got paid, so what's the difference anyway? I don't know if it's the fact that he's playing on a historically losing team. He's like, look, I might not just, what's the difference? We're going to lose anyway. Or maybe it's just like the sense of entitlement that he was the number one pick and never really got a chance to be the man on his own team. And he's probably just like, well, if you don't want me to be the man, then how about this? I just won't do a bunch of stuff that I'm supposed to be doing. And so maybe it's a combination of all those things. I don't know. The Heat should absolutely not go after Andrew Wiggins. I think that it's not been the best situation for him in Minnesota, but, you know, tough noogies. He's still making $20-plus million a year. So either make it a better situation for you or not. And if you're the Heat, you don't want to take on that contract with as many years as left on that. That's not – the Heat don't have a lot of chips. And you don't want to put your chips on that hand. You just don't want to do it. It's too risky. And so I just – I don't see – like, could Andrew Wiggins maximize his potential in Miami?
Absolutely.
He'd probably be better off in Miami than it was in Minnesota for the last several years. But I don't want the Heat to try. There's no interest in doing that. It doesn't make any sense. Ferris writes in – D'Angelo Russell. Any way Miami can snag him. His age and scoring fits perfect with the kids. Yeah, he does. It would be a great fit. I remember Heat fans really wanted D'Angelo. That was the same draft as Justice Winslow, right?
No, I think it was the year after.
Year after?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. I'm going to look that up. But I do think that he would be a really good fit in Miami. They just don't have the cap space to do so.
Yeah, he's entering unrestricted free agency now because he didn't sign a qualifying offer, as opposed to Justice having signed so last year, I think. Is that what it was? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Something like that. He bet on himself, and it worked. He's going to get paid.
He might not be all-star nod in Brooklyn, led them to the playoffs, had some pretty good clutch performances there. I mean, there are still holes in his game, and I'm not sure that he is...
It was the same draft. Sorry, it was the same draft as Justice Winslow. When Winslow went second, I remember everybody wanted. That was the year that he. That was like the first let's go ahead and tank year, and to go get D'Angelo Russell. So anyway,
4 years later, we're still getting calls for tanking.
Well, they haven't. So
yeah, no, I know. I mean, yeah, and I don't think they ever will. So I think it's time to put those calls to rest. I think that's what we're getting at. But
so you're getting at.
you still want them to tank?
I know. Why not? Complete yes.
I mean, this is a whole other discussion that could take...
Do it before the 2021 unprotected pick.
I don't know what the purpose of it is now. I mean, you're going to trade everybody off. I mean, who are you going to build around? Or are you going to keep anybody? Or is Richardson gone? Is Adebayo gone?
If you're talking about tanking... Put the ball in Deion's hands. That's all you got to do.
If you want to win 50-something games, yeah. I mean, Eastern Conference champs, sure.
D'Angelo Russell would be a great fit in Miami. The only way that they could possibly create enough cap space would be to... I mean, it would require Whiteside opting out, which, according to the Miami Herald, recently not going to happen. It would require trading Goran Dragic for one of these J.R. Smith-type non-guaranteed deals and then waiving that deal, creating cap space that way, and then getting off of a bunch of other salary. And that still would only... You know, I've played with the cap stuff. It's really hard to find a way to open up even $10 million, let alone 20, let alone 30. D'Angelo Russell is going to make a lot of money. So to answer Ferris's question here, any way Miami could snag him, no. There's just no. It seems like he's poised, like Indiana is going to have max cap space. There's a bunch of teams that are going to have a ton of cap space. They're just going to, that they have it. They already have it. They don't have to get creative and figure it out. They already have it.
I'd have concerns about paying Russell that kind of money.
Same. Yeah, you got to wonder if, you know, he hit an inordinate amount of mid-range shots last year. He made a bunch of mistakes. Like, as many great games as he had, like, the last 3 or 4 minutes, there were other games he just made so many mistakes late where he would just cough the ball up, make bad turnovers, bad reads against the defense in pick-and-roll situations. Like, I would have questions, too. I would, you know, I don't know if he's the guy that can lead a championship-level offense, which
I think Brooklyn's going to regret the decision, though, to if they do, in fact, wind up signing Kyrie Irving, as all the signs indicate will happen, I think that'll be a problem for Brooklyn, to be honest with you. Like, I mean, what made Brooklyn so good last year was this chemistry, this camaraderie bunch of guys that really were supportive of one another. At least, I mean, that's what everybody on that roster said publicly. I mean, and so I wonder why you would go about disrupting that with a player like Kyrie, who is, I don't think there's any argument that he's better than D'Angelo Russell, but mm-hmm. I mean, to say he's a divisive personality is probably putting it mildly.
The only other way that he could snag him is in a sign-and-trade deal, but I don't think D'Angelo Russell necessarily wants to play in Miami. I don't know. Maybe he does.
Yeah, he went to Ohio State, right? I mean, I don't know where he's from originally.
If Brooklyn passes on him for Kyrie, which seems to be the case, like you said, if the options are like, hey, Utah, Indiana, and then Miami, maybe. I mean, he's not going back to the Lakers. That's not happening.
Right.
The Knicks?
No. I don't know.
I mean, it depends. If they strike out on all these other guys, Kemba might stay in Charlotte. Like, maybe the Knicks. I don't know. There's a world where he says, look, I want to sign and trade Miami. And then Miami's like, great, we'll give you, like, I don't know. But I don't know why Brooklyn would then facilitate it. They don't strike me as a team that would want Whiteside or Goran Dragic or any of these other guys. So, I just don't count
Sean,
on it.
The Sean Marks connection with Riley isn't strong enough, you think?
Not to, like, yeah.
Jeopardize your team's future now.
Yeah, probably not. All right, let's take a quick break. But coming up, who is the best draft pick in Miami Heat history? And who is the worst? Thank you to our sponsors, Hotels.com. Thank you to Untuckit. And thank you to Grip Six Belts. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're on iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us. Mark writes in, aside from Dwayne Wade, who is Miami's best draft pick? And who is Miami's worst draft pick? It's a great question. You and I had a lot of fun before we started recording, kind of batting some of these ideas around. Do you want to start with best or worst?
Well, I think we should also mention that there was a caveat, or at least one that we put on ourselves. One, a pre-Riley era. I mean, Obviously Pat Riley's defined so much of what Miami's done over the last 24 years now. I mean, he joined the team in 95. But before that, I mean, obviously there was a pretty extensive draft history, one of which, you know, I think most of their best draft picks probably come during that era, to be 100% honest with you. So as far as best or worst, first let's start off with the best, because I think the best are pretty easy to determine.
Yeah, so you and I came up with basically Glenn Rice, number 5 pick in 1989's draft, and then Caron Butler in 2002, the 10th pick in that draft. That was the draft before the Dwayne Wade draft, right? So Glenn Rice was pre-Pat Riley. Caron mm-hmm. Butler was during the Riley era. But we went back. You and I batted up some other things around. Steve Smith, and some other guys. But the Glenn Rice draft stood out because you look at who else was taken in that draft. I mean, it was Purvis Ellison, number 1. Danny Ferry, number 2. Sean Elliott, number 3. Glenn Rice, number 4. And then right after Glenn Rice, you had guys named J.R. Reed, Stacey King, George McLeod, Randy White, Tom Hammonds, Pooh Richardson. Number 10 in that draft. Nick Anderson went 11 to the Magic. That wasn't a great draft considering the top. Like, other guys went late that ended up panning out. I mean, Tim Hardaway was in that draft at number 14. Wow. Sean Kemp went later. B.J. Armstrong went later. Other guys who had nice careers. But you look at who was in that kind of group where Glenn Rice was, and he was by far in that top 5, the best player at that group, and I would say, well, just because of that, he's probably the best pre-Riley pick.
Yeah, I mean, he was a great scorer. We talked about this when we did our all-time Heat teams. I mean, he was just a great perimeter shooter, had some, not necessarily explosive drive to the rim, but he was pretty capable. He had defensive issues, I think, but, you know, he did win a championship with the Lakers later on in his career. He was a 3-time All-Star with the Charlotte Hornets. I mean, he was a really, really good player, and you know, I remember it being a pretty, you know, disheartening moment to hear that he was the one who had been traded to Charlotte in exchange for Alonzo Mourning. Obviously, a move that paid off pretty well for both Mourning and Riley, but, you know, giving up in the Glenn Rice era kind of, you know, it's funny because we talked about recently how Pat Riley seems to have kind of softened a little bit, not willing to make the harder decisions. That seemed like a pretty hard one. Like, he came into the Miami franchise right away and said, no, I want a franchise center. Sorry, guy that's been here for 6 seasons. We're moving you right away, despite all your shooting, all your potential, et cetera. And he shipped Glenn Rice right away. And so that was kind of a signal that things were going to be different in Miami. And it kind of, I mean, as far as Rice's overall career, yeah, a hell of a player. And I think clearly Miami's best draft pick before Pat Riley actually arrived and to make decisions later on.
And then being that key piece that landed Alonzo Mourning, right? That matters. Sure. That sure. Like, he was a great asset acquired at number five. That part matters too, and that kind of relates to the Riley, our best pick during the Riley era, Caron Butler. In 2002, you get him at the 10th pick. He had a really promising rookie season next to Dwayne Wade, and it looked like they really had a good core going forward. Or not, it was his second season next to Dwayne Wade. Dwayne Wade's rookie season. Right. But that core got them to the playoffs.
It did.
And they seemed to have a real promising thing going on, and then Shaquille O'Neal becomes available. And Caron becomes a key part, in addition to Lamar Odom, Brian Grant, a key piece in that trade that landed Shaquille O'Neal. So even though Caron Butler was only in Miami for one season,
yeah,
he is probably the best pick, non-Dwayne Wade pick, in the Pat Riley era, because he was a huge asset in trying to land in trading for Shaquille O'Neal. And then, of course, Butler, he didn't just fizzle out. He had a great career. So. Yeah. I would say Caron Butler was the best.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear too. I mean, he had a two-time All-Star, 13-year career, you know, played for a number of teams, but was always a really good contributor. So it's, you know, you look at the 10th pick in the draft, you're not sure what you're going to hit on. I know they were hoping that Caron would be an All-Star. He had won a championship at UConn, and a lot like Justice, he was a guy who was supposed to be selected early on in the draft and then kind of slid and slid and slid. And, you know, he wound up having a really prolific, really good career. Maybe not a great one. He might not have been a superstar. But this is kind of what you know, now in conjunction with the draft that we're looking at in a couple of days. I mean, you're not sure if you're going to hit on a superstar. You might. You might hit on one on 25. You might hit on one in the second round. You might get a Gilbert Arenas. You might get an Isaiah Thomas that has one really good breakout season. But for the most part, you're hitting on guys that you want to, at the very least, be solid contributors. And I think Caron was not just a solid contributor, but he was a pretty good one. Not in Miami, because he didn't have that opportunity, although he did shine for a couple of seasons. But he had, again, a very long, solid career, and I think that's all you can potentially hope for.
I think other guys, honorable mentions, so to speak, Mario Chalmers, Josh Richardson, they're obviously up there. Yes. Absolutely. I think Richardson has a real strong case to be the best during the Riley era, but it's just, I don't know. I don't know if it's too early. I think you could honestly make an opinion. You can make, given where you took Josh Richardson, you can make a real solid argument that he was the best during the Riley era.
I mean, he has had a better impact in Miami just because he's been here for 4 years. But
yeah, and
would
get
you
him
say
with
he's
the
a better player than Caron Butler? I mean, maybe that's a good thing too. I think it shows that Miami has had, for the most part, pretty good analysis when it comes to the draft. I mean, their scouting department has done a really good job of analyzing players and looking at how their talents will project to the NBA level. Yeah. And I think that's clear. And when you're selecting guys in the second round, like Chalmers, like Richardson, and knowing that they have the potential to make it in the league.
I mean, Chalmers, best point guard on two championship teams. Josh Richardson, 18 point per game scorer thereabouts in the second round. Yeah, good arguments for them too. Worst draft pick in Heat history. I know you had an opinion on the pre-Pat Riley era worst pick.
I know we're going to edit this up. I completely blank. Sorry. No. Can you edit this part out?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear, unfortunately. Harold Miner, you know, a lot of hope and expectation for him. Selected in 92 in the lottery, the 12th overall pick. There were really unfair expectations. The moniker Baby Jordan never really helped. And, you know, it wasn't like Miner was a terrible player, but there was so much expectation, so much burden placed on him after a really solid career at USC. And again, the nickname didn't help because, you know, the real Michael Jordan was still in the league at that point in time. And, you know, you're kind of comparing this guy to an all-time great, if not the all-time best player. And so, you know, you never... there's no way that you could potentially live up to that. And that was the era of a lot of heir apparents. You know, there was Grant Hill. There was Penny Hardaway. Vince Carter at one point. There were so many guys that were supposed to take over as the next Jordan. Nobody really matching what Jordan was able to do. And I think Harold Miner was clearly the worst of those. But again, he only lasted a couple of seasons. And I don't know that he ever really wanted to be a superstar player, and there were the expectations that were there that come with being the 12th pick, and it just never panned out for him, and that's fine. I think I saw a story about him recently where he's somewhat happy, to be honest with you. Like, he's got a happy life away from basketball. He doesn't think about it anymore, and I'm glad to see him being able to move on.
Other worst picks during the Pat Riley era, we talked about Wayne Simmien at number 29. And Darrell Wright at number 19. And I think both of those would maybe surprise listeners. But just like you have to do with the best draft picks, you kind of have to look at who was picked around and after those guys. Yeah. And I remember my dad, Wayne Simmien, drafted 2005, 2 years after the Dwayne Wade draft. And my dad loved Wayne Simmien. He was like, this guy is going to be the backcourt partner next to Dwayne Wade. We're going to You know, and that was kind of the whole thing. And I remember even the Heat's broadcast crew loved Wayne Simmien. And
did he win a championship in Kansas? I thought he had, right?
I think so. Yeah. And everybody loved Wayne Simmien. And he was one of those guys who just really never, like, he would flash in moments. He would get like a big rebound. He would hit an outside shot and be like, oh, okay, great. And then just like never really put it all together. And then you look at who was taken after Wayne Simmien in that 2005 draft. So he goes number 29. David Lee goes number 30 right after that. And you know, that was before Florida was really Florida. But it was still, like, they still had, the pipeline was there. It was laid down by Udonis Haslam. You know, it would have been interesting to see David Lee and Haslam together in the front court. That was before David Lee obviously was a dinosaur in the NBA. He was a really good player for a while. Other guys, CJ Miles went later. Irsan Ilyasova, Monte Ellis went later in that draft. Lou Williams went later in that draft. I mean, a bunch of guys who had nice NBA careers. Marcin Gortat went 57. So guys who are still in the league, unlike Wayne Simmien. So I think that was, you know, it's hard to say that the 29th pick, you know, you don't really have high expectations for that guy. But given who was taken later in the draft, you got to say that was probably one of the worst picks. And that also, you know, there hasn't been a huge bust, you know. And we're not talking about Michael Beasley here because he was obviously the second best player in that draft, and you had to take him if you had the second pick. So I don't even include Michael Beasley in here. But, you know, it sort of goes to show that Pat Riley overall has had a pretty decent draft history. If he's guilty of anything, it's trading away players and trading away picks before they have a chance to pan out.
The Simmien pick also kind of shows, you know, some tendencies in Riley's selection process where, you know, Simmien was a four-year player, a guy who he hadn't won a championship. I was wrong. He actually made it to the Final Four a number of times and was a runner-up. So he was a team that lost in the championship game. But, you know, he kind of saw similar attributes in Simmien that he would see later on in Richardson, you know, another four-year player with potential, et cetera. And in Simeon's case, he was a leader of that Kansas team. He was a really solid player. And they just kind of fell in love with his size, his abilities. You know, he was not quite a floor spacer, but he had a longer mid-range shot. And I think, you know, at that point in time, there wasn't as much emphasis on three-point shooting, especially at the power forward spot. So there was a hope there that he could be, like you said, the front court partner to Dwayne Wade in the backcourt. But, you know, it just unfortunately never panned out. So
other honorable mentions, Darrell Wright. He'd pick him in 2004 with the 19th pick. It didn't have a terrible career, but, you know,
he flourished outside of Miami. I mean, that was a big thing, right? He found his shooting stroke in Portland, I want to say. And then
Portland
he was
and Golden State, right?
Golden State, yeah. He was a contributor for those teams.
I saw Darrell Wright at like 2 in the morning in a chicken and waffles place out here.
Nice.
I think he still lives out here. And he walked in, you know, and he's what, 6'5", 6'7", something like that. He walks in, and I'm like, this dude looks so familiar. And I just figured obviously this guy's a basketball player. Like, this is not a player on the Warriors right now. And it took me, like, probably 4 or 5 minutes before I realized it was Darrell Wright.
Well, remind me to tell you off air where I've seen a couple of Heat players, not in places that we should get into.
Jameer Nelson was picked after Darrell Wright, Delonte West, Tony Allen, Kevin Martin, Beno Udrih, Heat legend, Anderson Varejao. These guys
also Heat legend for all the wrong reasons.
Honorable mention, Shabazz Napier. Oof. He's panned out since then, just wasn't good in Miami. They probably could have taken somebody more impactful for that year.
Looking at this list of players that have been selected, not some great ones, you know, I'll tell you. Yeah. Jason Smith, I never thought he was going to pan out. I mean, tall, you know, it doesn't look the part, let's just put it that way. And he's wound up having a pretty solid career, although I think that's he may not be in the league next year for the first time in a long time.
The NBA draft is Thursday night. We're hoping that it'll be one of the best picks for the Miami Heat and not one of the worst. But that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Connect with us on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat or email us at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. We will have a recap for you following the draft Thursday night. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.
Yeah! Up,